The Tom Woods Show, episode 816.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Happy New Year. Back for 2017. If you're on my email list, you know that I decided to resume the show today and take yesterday off. So I did that and spent some time with the kids and had lots of fun. And I was out of town for a week with them. And we all had a great time aboard the Independence of the Seas, because that's something I like to do, is go on cruises with the family. We did that, had a wonderful time. But now I am back and ready to go. Got some excellent guests and topics lined up for this week. What I thought I'd do today is just cover a few miscellaneous topics that are on my mind and that are answering some listener questions, and also talk about what, to my mind, was the greatest loss of 2016. There's been a lot of talk about celebrity deaths in 2016. Well, all I can say is the death that left the greatest impact, had the greatest impact on me, was the death of Ralph Raico, the libertarian historian. He was 80 years old. I got to know him all the way back in 1992. I met him at a week-long seminar put on by the Institute for Humane Studies, and then I got to know him a little bit better at events hosted by the Mises Institute. Ralph Raico was a brilliant guy, and I just wish he had written more. And in fact, I remember probably about 10 years ago, I said to him, "You owe it to mankind to write more." And his response was, "I loathe mankind." Well, how are you going to argue with that? But he was a longtime friend of Murray Rothbard, whom he got to know in the 1950s. He attended Ludwig von Mises' New York University graduate seminar that George Riesman and Rothbard and others also attended. Paul Cantor, who's been a guest on this show, also attended that seminar. So he's been around in libertarian circles for a long, long time. And he had a great influence on me. I learned a tremendous amount from him. And in fact, just the other day on my email list, I sent to everybody a copy of Raico's book, Great Wars and Great Leaders, A Libertarian Rebuttal. It's free because of the great work the Mises Institute does in getting the word out to everybody. They make that book available for free. That's a book by Raico that is fantastic. It goes into a lot of material relating to World War I, on which Raico was an expert, and he was likewise an expert on the disputed question of the war guilt, the starting of the war, and who was the actor who was most responsible for the outbreak of the war. And he had a lot to say about the so-called Fischer thesis that blamed it on Germany, because the original, the Treaty of Versailles, blamed it on Germany, and then there was the revisionist work that said, no, it was either everybody's fault, or Germany was the least to blame, or the British were to blame, or whatever. And then in the 1960s, you got the Fischer thesis, where the pendulum swung back to Germany again, and now there are revisionists of that revision, like Raico, who argued against that. He sorts that all out for you in that book, but he's also got his classic chapter on Winston Churchill, who's a great hero to many people. Raico's not so convinced that we should feel that way. He's got a great takedown of Woodrow Wilson. It's a wonderful book, and that's why I sent it out to everybody on my list. If you're not on my list, by the way, you can get on it at tomsfreebooks.com. Pick a free ebook. You can get all of them if you want, but the first libertarian book that you get on that page will hop you onto my libertarian list, and then the Five Paths to an Online Income book will hop you onto my entrepreneurship list. But anyway, so I sent this book out to everybody and got a lot of clicks, but a lot of people opened that baby up. Free book. I love my list, by the way, people on my email list. Free book, and they're salivating. Wait, I'm going to climb over my own family members to grab that free book. Great, great. You are my kind of people. So in any event, Raico wrote about a wide variety of topics within European history. First of all, not only did he study under Mises at the NYU seminar, he got his PhD at the University of Chicago, and he worked under F.A. Hayek. So again, he knew a lot of people. He founded a publication some of you may be familiar with from the 1960s called New Individualist Review. And it was such a great publication that Liberty Fund wound up publishing all the issues in a single bound volume. I have that. I cherish that thing. There were tremendous articles published in that over the years, and they collected them all into this one beautifully bound volume. Well, Rako founded and helped edit that, and apparently Milton Friedman, looking back on those days, later said that that publication had not, in fact, what were his exact words here? That publication, he said, set an intellectual standard which has not yet, I believe, been matched by any of the more recent publications in the same philosophical tradition. Well, that's high praise from Milton Friedman. So Rako was an important figure and knew an awful lot. And as I say, he wrote widely on a variety of topics. He could speak to you about the great classical liberals of the 18th century, the 17th century, the forerunners of classical liberalism, by which, of course, we roughly mean libertarianism for my American listeners. He could speak with authority on the debate over the Industrial Revolution and whether it represented progress or retrogression for the average person. And I learned a lot about the historiography of the Industrial Revolution by listening to Ralph Rako. He talked about the source of the European miracle. Why was it that Europe saw continuous cumulative economic growth, and it was the first in the world to do so consistently and systematically over time? Why was that? What was it that made that possible? Well, the answers to that question are pretty darn important because they tell us a lot about where we should be going in when it comes to deciding on policy today. So lots of topics you can learn about from Ralph Rako. So I would urge you to check out tomwoods.com/816, because there I will also link that book, Great Wars and Great Leaders, A Libertarian Rebuttal. In fact, let me jot that down right now, because wouldn't it be heartbreaking if you went all the way there and there was no book? So Great Wars, just writing this down. All right, good. All right, let's move on to a few other things that I want to mention, just because I get them a lot. For example, if you are a longtime listener of this show, you know that one of the ideas that has been associated with me simply because I wrote a book about it is nullification. Not jury nullification, although I also favor that. We've talked about that on the show at least a couple of times. But we're talking about state nullification. Nullification by a state of an unconstitutional federal law. I'm associated with that because I wrote a book called Nullification in the year 2010. And I think the case for it is absolutely airtight. The historical case is very strong. Constitutional case is strong. The moral case is strong. I mean, I think it's a compelling argument. Well, what I get a lot is the following question. I mean, so much that I'm taking it on right now. I get, Woods, I'm just curious, if a state may nullify a federal law, can a town nullify a state law? I get this a lot. And the answer to that question is, it depends on what you mean by can. You remember when you were in school and your annoying teacher, when you would say, can I go to the bathroom? Or can I sharpen my pencil? Your teacher will say, yes, you can. Meaning, yes, you physically are able to do those things. Because the teacher was waiting for you to say, may I sharpen my pencil or may I go to the bathroom? That is probably one of the most annoying things any teacher could ever do. Shut up already. You know what I mean when I'm asking, can I go to the bathroom? I'm not actually asking you, am I physically capable of relieving myself? But you did get that in school. And I get, all right, you should say may. But there are other ways to ask kids to do that than that ridiculous response. Anyway, what am I even talking about here? Now I've even forgotten where I was going. Well, anyway, yeah, it depends on what you mean by can. Because, yes, they can resist a state law in the sense that they are physically capable of doing it. They could try it. And maybe in some cases they might even get away with it if the law is not that important or the state government feels like it has other fish to fry. They might in fact get away with it. But do you mean are they allowed to do it? Well, no. And of course, in the same way, a state is not thought to be allowed to nullify a federal law. But I frankly don't care what people who go to American law schools think about the subject, because none of them learn anything other than case law. They learn a lot of John Marshall. They don't learn anything about the state ratifying conventions, which is where the meaning of the Constitution was fleshed out. And remember, in Marshall's cases, John Marshall's Chief Justice of the U.S. from 1801 to 1835, in all of his decisions in that 34-year period, not one footnote appears to the state ratifying conventions. Not one. So, no, I don't care about the nationalist view of the Constitution that people get in American law schools. I care about the real thing. And so I think a state is absolutely justified in nullifying federal laws. But the point is that a state has certain arguments at its disposal that a town would not have. A state can say the states created the federal government, after all. The states sent delegates to the Constitutional Convention, and the Constitution was then adopted and ratified by state, not in a gigantic blob vote of the whole American people. There was no such thing as the American people. There were the peoples of the individual states, and they approved the Constitution state by state, which indicates that states are the key thing. And then they can go into that we see in the Virginia Ratifying Convention that it's quite clear that if a state, that a state in effect can nullify. And I give all the evidence for this in the book, and I've gone over it many times and probably in a few episodes of this very show. What those arguments by and large boil down to is that the states are the creators in this situation. And the created thing does not tell the creator what it can do. Well, the towns, by contrast, are not the creators of the states. The states created the towns, basically, is more or less what happened. So the towns are not in a position to make the kind of constitutional and historical arguments that states are in a position to make. So yeah, they could try to do it, but they're not arguing from the standpoint of a state and with the historical grounding and logical grounding that a state has. Look, we created this thing. We're not going to let our own creation destroy us. A town can't say that about a state. So try it if you want, but I think you'd have a harder, tougher row to hoe on that one. Then let me answer this question that came in. Let me get this baby up here. It's in my other email account. The guy says the following thing. I have an ad blocker on Firefox. So the other day, I opened an article from womenshealthmag.com, and my ad blocker blocked 24 ads straight out of the gate on this site, plus a bunch of tracking software, and a fistful of pop-ups. Then the site blocked their own content and dissed me for blocking their ads. I mean, they spoke to me as if I was morally reprehensible. And this isn't the first time lately I've run into this sort of thing. So I'm trying to give this, again, I'm just reading what this listener wrote in. I'm trying to give this a fair shake from an Austrian school point of view. First, I don't mind a few ads. No, really. In fact, I kind of like a few ads because I'm always curious. And it's helpful if someone brings ideas and opportunities to me instead of me having to always do all the work of hunting them down. All right, so he really understands the value of advertising. Good. Good. I have no truck with or sympathy for people who are anti-advertising. We are pro-advertising on the Tom Woods Show. On the other hand, he says, even if I was vitally interested in every single ad website slung at me, I simply do not have the time to pay attention to every single one of them, and especially when it's at the expense of the time I wanted to spend actually reading the content of an article. So since things were getting completely out of hand, I got an ad blocker, a good one. Peace. My time is once again my own to spend. Yet, these folks are perfectly legitimately trying to make a buck. So now I whip out the old price is imputed back from the consumer shtick and reason that if you want me to give you money in exchange for something, then I have to value what you have more than my hard-earned cash or my time, which is the same thing. Thus, it seems to me that folks have perhaps defecated where they comesticate on the principle of more is better with regard to any other principle or consideration in packing as many ads into their content in as many ways as they can imagine. And then finally, do you think this might spell the downfall of online advertising as it's currently practiced? Maybe ad blockers can be made illegal. Too bad for the ad blocker software producers, but with any luck, they have a strong lobby, right? And so then he says, how does affiliate marketing stack up against this? What's the distinction, if any, between the two? I wonder what route affiliate marketing will take going forward if content advertisers cotton onto it. All right, well, I'm not sure about the relationship with affiliate marketing, but that is an interesting kind of Austrian analysis of advertising. First of all, we see the value of advertising, that it does actually, sometimes in a clunky way, but it does convey information to you. I mean, there's a reason that you'll find, let's say, auto part advertisements in a golf magazine. In addition to advertisements for golf equipment, you might also see something about a car. Well, that's because people who read these magazines tend to be interested in those things. So that's actually a convenience. They're bringing the information to you. They're bringing it to where you're likely to be. You, the person who's most likely to want this thing or need this thing, it's brought to you. So there is value in advertising. There's there are whole schools of economics that want to try to analyze the economy as if there's no advertising, because advertising disrupts their perfect competition model where information is uniformly and evenly spread across society. Well, that is not the case. That's unrealistic. So we should actually incorporate advertising into the way we think. Well, anyway, all right. Well, so what about this case of a site that's just bombarding you with ads and pop-ups, just bombarding you, and then you can't view it because if you have an ad blocker on, they sense that and they stop you from viewing it. All right, well, okay, in this case, it is a case of you're not entitled to view the material on that site. And the listener who wrote into me obviously gets that. I don't have a right to read their content. And on the other hand, I feel like I don't have to be bombarded constantly by ads. And yet at the same time, I feel conflicted because I think it's legitimate of them to want to earn a buck. So what do I do? And I say, or, you know, what happens here? In other words, what happens in this situation? I say this is up to entrepreneurs to figure out. That's what they're there for. That's what they're good at, is figuring out how to monetize things that are hard to monetize. So, for instance, television programs in the 1950s. Well, everybody who has a TV can turn it on and get the program. So I can't charge them to get the program. Only later did they figure out they could charge you for cable TV. But initially, how am I going to charge you for this programming? Answer, we put ads in the programming. We figure out a way to monetize it one way or another. Or we do content placement in TV programs. Somebody's drinking a Coke or something like that. We do that. We always come up with clever ways of doing it. Well, in the case of these sites, if it turns out that they're not losing that many readers by having this policy, you know, that you've got to look at our ads to get our content, then it works for them. But if over time they feel like they're losing a lot of readers, and but yet they can't afford to go without the revenue, well, then my answer would be then they've got to figure out another way to generate revenue. Because sometimes the way you generate revenue is a little bit more indirect than the old banner ad in your face. There are more indirect ways to generate revenue. One of them is by building up some kind of a subscription offer where we'll give you access to our forums or our huge archives of all kinds of reports and videos and courses and whatever that will help you. You can subscribe to this for $4 a month. You get this huge member area plus an ad-free site. That's another way to monetize. It doesn't have to all be banner ads for Good Housekeeping, right? You think of other ways to monetize. Or you build up an email list from the site. You give away a free book, you build up an email list, and then occasionally you pitch an affiliate offer to that email list, or you pitch your own product to that email list. And people who don't want to get those offers, if they really think you're not giving them any value, they can unsubscribe from the list. But this is a second way to reach people. Another way to reach them is by tracking them down on Facebook. You go on Facebook, you do a Facebook ad, and you have the audience be your website traffic from your website. And you get those people targeted on Facebook, you send them your ad. Now, to do that, you have to know how to use the Facebook pixel, stuff like that, but that can be done. So I think there are lots of ways to grab people. You primarily want to build up that email list. And you can use that email list, if you know what you're doing, you can use it to generate income. So I've got two main email lists. One of them is my libertarian list. I already told you can get on it at tomsfreebooks.com if you get one of the libertarian books. And another one's an entrepreneurship list that you can get if you get my Paths to Income book, which is also at tomsfreebooks.com. And I send good content pretty much every weekday. I miss a day once in a while, but I'm a father of five. That's bound to happen. Sometimes I write on the weekends if I have time and I feel like I have something to say. And I send out good content. I mean, there's good content on that list. And when people unsubscribe, I'm glad they unsubscribe. Because I say to myself, look, I'm clearly sending out valuable content that people learn stuff from and benefit from and profit from. And if that's not resonating with you, then you don't belong on this list. Then, you know, good. I'm glad you're gone. I want the list to be laser targeted to people who appreciate the value in it. I want it to go to people who wouldn't dream of unsubscribing. They'd say, of course I value this. Those are the people I want. I don't weep any tears about losing subscribers. I gain more subscribers every day than I lose. So that's what matters to me. So I would do that. So the point is, there are a lot of ways they can do this that don't involve this strategy. There are ways they can monetize what they're doing that don't involve this. And so if it turns out that this is not working for them, then I think they have options. And if none of those options work, then the question is their content really valued sufficiently in the first place for us to be worried about it at all? Also, on the pop-up question, let's say about that. Everybody hates that, right? You're on a website, boom, something pops up, and you just X out of it. You hate that. But stop and think. This is something you should think of as a marketer. When there's some marketing device that you feel like not only you hate, but you're pretty sure everybody hates. Like, you've never met anybody who likes pop-ups in your life. All right. But think more deeply here. If everybody hated them to the point where no one ever responded to a pop-up, they would have disappeared long ago. The reason there are pop-ups on websites is that they work. Now, I'm not saying have 12 pop-ups. Shouldn't have any more than one. But pop-ups work. And if you have a website and you're trying to collect email addresses and you don't have a pop-up, then you're doing it wrong. You absolutely should have a pop-up. Now, I got two different things on my sites. One of them is a notify me button where you click on it and then there's a pop-up. So you get the pop-up on your time. But for people who can't be persuaded to click on that, I'm a little bit less subtle when they try to leave. When they try to leave, I got to put this on Contra Krugman. I haven't done it yet. But when you try to leave TomWoods.com or HappyEarner.com, you can't leave without me giving you one last chance to hop onto my list and get my free book. And that pop-up uses what's called exit intent technology. It can tell that you are about to leave my site. And just as you're about to leave, that pop-up comes up. That works fantastically well. Because these are a lot of people I would never, ever be able to reach ever again. I can get some of them. I can keep some of them and reach out to those people in the future. So I absolutely want to do that. So I use Opt-in Monster. It's linked at tomwoods.com/resources. I use that because I like the exit intent technology. Now, I've got it so that if the pop-up has appeared, I think it's like, I forget how many days it is before it'll appear again. Like, if you X out of it, it's not going to keep hounding you every time you go to my site. But also, nice feature of this, and then I'll get off this subject, but I'm very interested in this. If you're already on my email list, and then in the email, I link you to an article on my site, and then you go to my site, I don't want that pop-up appearing, inviting you to get my ebook and get on my list. You're already on my list. I don't want to bother you with the pop-up. So I put in a little code in the URL. It's a /?omhide=true. What that does is when you click on that link and visit my site, it tells my site, don't bother this person with the pop-up. This person's already on the list. We don't need to recruit this person. So it's neat the way this all works. But anyway, pop-ups generally work. All right, another thing I want to talk about. When to respond. When do you respond to a critic? I've had a couple of very low-profile critics over the past few weeks who have been writing, you know, irritating things about me, and I have not responded in any way, not in any way. And people are saying to me, Woods, you have the patience and self-restraint of a saint. And I say, oh my gosh, no. It took me years to get to this point. And it's not that I have self-restraint. It's the, how shall I put this? It's the genuine not caring. That's what helps. It's the not caring. Not caring anymore. My view is if it's a super high-profile outlet or person, then I have to respond. In the old days, I'm telling you, I used to relish that. Today, it's more of a grim sense of duty, let's say, out of which I respond when people go after me. But if it's somebody nobody's ever heard of and has an audience of 100, what possible point could there be? All I'm doing is elevating that person. I'm doing exactly what that person wants. I'm not going to do that. And I just don't read the stuff. People say, oh, you got to read what this guy's saying about you. But you know what? I don't. I don't have to read what that person is saying about me. And for those of you who are jumping online and starting blogs and, you know, responding to all my talk about that, be careful that you too don't fall into this trap of doing a Google alert on your name and getting emailed alerts every time your name is mentioned. And then you feel like you have to go to that blog and defend yourself. I had a, when my Politically Incorrect Guide to American History book came out in 2004, I had a blog say that Columbia University should revoke my PhD. Now that really annoyed me. And in fact, I may have responded to that, come to think of it, because I was in this mode of must respond to everything. But who are these losers? Do they have a Columbia University PhD? Who are they to say that? And what do they know about my dissertation? They don't evaluate your PhD on the basis of future books you might one day write. You know, we don't have a preemptive war when it comes to PhD awarding. They give it to you on the basis of the strength of your dissertation, which, by the way, mine was published by Columbia University Press. You can see it at tomwoods.com/books. The Church Confronts Modernity. You look at the reviews that thing got in all the major historical journals. Pretty darn good. The Journal of American History loved that book. Major, major professional historian periodicals that I despise and wouldn't want to be caught dead in actually loved that book. So yeah, you know, I earned that baby fair and square, and just because I said a few things that you can't abide and have absolutely no idea how to refute doesn't mean Columbia should yank my degree from me. Crazy. But just ignore it. It doesn't do you any good, and you know what? It interferes with your normal disposition, tranquility, and you just don't want that. You just don't want it. Who cares? Who cares? Nobody reads these blogs. That are attacking you, and nobody who might be inclined to be on your side is reading them. It's people who are going to hate you anyway, and who by tomorrow have already forgotten your name. Why care? Now, if Keith Olbermann, back in the days when he was on MSNBC, and he used to have a feature called The Worst Person in the World, if he attacked me on that, oh, I'd have fun responding to that. That'd be great, because I would be parlaying that. Nobody would remember my name who's an MSNBC watcher, but I sure would build up my street cred with a lot of people who are inclined to like me. This happened to Brian McClanahan once, by the way, frequent guest of this show and a professor at LibertyClassroom.com. Brian was called the worst person in the world on MSNBC. I forget why. I'm sure it was for some great thing he did. And he was worried about this, I think, if I'm remembering this right. He was a little worried. And I said, no, Brian, what? you just won the Pulitzer Prize. This is great. This is, does not hurt you in any way. There's no way this hurts you. And then plus you can write a response or do a video and build on the talk about the segment. So that's how I decide. I've gotten to a point, I used to be obsessed with this stuff, and now I just don't care, and my life is a lot happier. All right. One final thing I want to tell you, and this applies to those of you who are in two cities in America. And if you say, but Woods, I'm not in one of those cities. Why should I listen? Well, hold on, because who knows when I will be coming to a city near you. All right, here it is. I'm about to improve your life. If you're not familiar with these things, I think I've talked about them on the show before. Escape rooms or escape games. We get a lot of them in Orlando. The idea is you get locked in a room, although in Florida, because of state law, they're not allowed to lock you in the room. So anyway, the door is closed and you're in this room for an hour and there's some story related to it. Like you're trying to track down evidence of something in some office or whatever. You're trapped in such and such and you got to figure out a way out or you got to solve the puzzle of the room. And to do it, you got to look around for clues and puzzles and solve them and put your heads together and figure out exactly what's going on. Sometimes there are secret rooms in the room. Like you solve a puzzle and a door opens, a door you didn't even know was there. So it's very, very interesting. We absolutely love doing it. And some of them you can take, you know, I have five girls and my three oldest who are 10, 11, and 13, soon to be 10, 12, and 13, really, really enjoy doing them, even if they're not as engaged as the adults are. But they have still found things that I didn't find or made connections that I didn't connect, so it's been really great to have them. And one of the things I did for Christmas was I bought a gift certificate for one of the my favorite escape room in Orlando, which is MindQuest Live Orlando. I bought a gift certificate so that just my 10-year-old and I would go. That was the gift. One of her Christmas gifts was that the two of us alone would go because she likes it the most. And we thought, if the two of us just put our heads together, let's see how we do. So they're really, really great fun, and they're popping up everywhere. There's a whole bunch of them in Orlando, as I say. So what I did when I was in Boston at the end of last year for the Mises Institute event was I said, I like to do escape rooms, and I want to do them in different cities when I'm traveling. So I did two escape rooms in Boston, one on a Friday night, one on a Saturday night, and I was joined by my supporting listeners from the show who lived in the area. And I said, usually it's like 25 or 30 bucks a person to do these. It's going to be my treat. You guys support the show, I'm going to give you this nice goodie. And we had, I can say without fear of contradiction, we had an absolutely great time down to the last person. Everybody loved it. The first night we almost escaped. The second night, where we did a different room and a different group of people, we did successfully escape. It was so much fun. Jeff Deist of the Mises Institute was there with us. What fun. So look up escape games in your area on Google. Well, anyway, I'm coming to San Diego February 25th, 2017 for the Mises event that day. And that night, I have an escape room in mind that I want to do. And I just sent this out in an email to my list. And I mentioned it in my private Facebook group for the supporting listeners. So if you want to do one of these with me and you're in the San Diego area, then drop me a line at tomwoods.com on the contact page. You got to be a supporting listener of the show. So either you're one now or you join and then you write to me. One way or another, let me know at tomwoods.com/contact that that's something you'd like to do. And I'll add you to the list. And if we have overflow, I'll put you on a wait list because we always get a few people who drop out. I don't know why, because you're going to have the time of your life. And we'll do that. Secondly, I want to arrange a few of them for Orlando because I live in the area. I'm less than an hour away. And it would be fun to do that with some of you folks who live in Central Florida. So if you have any interest at all in doing an escape room with me, then go to tomwoods.com, go to the contact page, and subject line, just put Florida escape room, and then let me know that you're interested in this. And I'll put you on a little list where I'll let you know when I've decided to do it. Now, I can't really negotiate times. Then it'll never get done. I can't negotiate times with 40 people. But I'll tell you, this is when we're doing it, and you write back to me within 24 hours if you can make it. And if not, then we'll have to try again some other time. But I just think it would be fun to get together with a lot of you guys. Again, I'll pay for it. If you're a supporter of the show, I'll pay for it, and we'll have some fun and see if we can escape from some rooms. So supportinglisteners.com is how you become a supporting listener, and tomwoods.com, the contact page, is how you let me know I just did that, and now let's escape from a room in San Diego or Orlando or perhaps some other cities that I may be traveling to over the course of 2017. All right, that is it, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.